White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening and happy Halloween to all you students of the International Jew. It is October 31st, 2013, and we are at episode 71 and chapter 66. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hadding Scott.
And are you going to have a good Halloween Eve? This is not Halloween Eve, Halloween night, Hadding?
It's very quiet. I consider that good.
Yes, me too. Same here.
2013 and it's Halloween. So scary.
So scary. Well, we might have some scary things to say tonight. The Jews are always scary, aren't they? And our chapter tonight is about Americanism and whether Jews have ever accepted to become Americanized or whether they instead have wanted to Judaize America. Does that sound about right?
Well, yeah. Yeah. Okay. It's about the it ends up being about the relationship between Jews and the modern nation state.
Mhm. Yeah. That's good.
Right. And they seem to perceive a danger and a problem there for the survival of their somewhat independent polity within each country that they inhabit.
Yeah, we'll have to hope that we get finished early enough. And there is a lot of little things to comment on, and this is another good one. But if we finish early enough to comment a little bit to sort of sum up what this chapter concludes with, it would be a good idea, I'm sure. All right, so let's just go ahead and get started.
All right, chapter 66, The Jews' Complaint Against Americanism. From the earliest record of the Jews' contact with other nations, no long period of years has ever passed without the charge arising that the Jews constitute a people within a people, a nation within a nation. When this charge is made today, it is vehemently denied by men who pose as the defenders of their people, and the denial is more or less countenanced by all the Jews of every class. And yet there is nothing more clearly stated in Jewish teaching, nor more clearly indicated in Jewish life, than that the charge is true. But whether the charge should be used against whether the truth should be used against the Jews is quite another question. If the Jews are a nation, their nationality founded upon the double ground of race and religion, it is certainly outside the bounds of reason that they should be asked or expected to de-racialize, de-nationalize, and de-religionize themselves. But neither is it to be expected that they should bitterly denounce those who state the facts. It is only upon a basis of facts that a solution of any problem can come. Where blame attaches is here, that the evident facts are denied as if no one but the Jews themselves knew that there are such facts.
You know, I think that's very good. I mean, they say things that are so simple but so profound that, that obviously they're saying here that all these people, particularly a lot of Jews, are denouncing them, the Dearborn Independent, and their what their chapters that they're putting in the newspaper, all of this international Jew stuff. They're denouncing that when they're saying they're only stating the facts. And then they say that only on the basis of facts can there be any solution to the problem. Of course, they're saying that there's a Jewish problem. And the Jews, no doubt, deny that there's a problem, at least not the way that the that people like the Ford people define it. So
they don't want us to think about the problem.
Right.
You know, but it's evident enough from the sources quoted just in this article that they know that there is a problem.
Yeah, there you go.
Just want to be the ones to solve it their way, you know, apparently. I guess I'll continue.
Yes.
If the Jews are to be continuously a nation, as they teach, and if the condition of a nation within a nation becomes more and more intolerable, then the solution must come through one of two things: a separation of the nation from the rest of the nations, or an exaltation of the nation above the rest of the nations.
Well, that's good too, see. And so then they got Israel later on, and for their own nation, and yet they cling to everywhere else that they are. And the National Socialists tried to get German Jews to go to Israel, and were attacked by World Jewry for it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. See, they just, there's no way that you can work things out with these people. That's what I would conclude. That's all.
There is a mass of evidence in Jewish writings that the leaders expect both of these conditions to come: a separate nation and a supranation. Supranation, it says here. Indeed, the heart of Jewish teaching is, as quite fully illustrated in the last article, that Jewry is a separate nation now, and on the way to becoming a supranation. It is only those appointed to address the Gentiles who deny this. The real rabbinate of Israel does not deny. Israel, in this case, just meaning the Jews, since there was no
right.
state of Israel at the time.
Right. So who is he talking about then? Who are they talking about exactly? The separate nation and a supranation, that Jewry is a separate nation, and they're on their way to becoming a supranation, but only those appointed to address the Gentiles who are the ones who deny this. But the real Jews don't deny it. The Jews don't really deny it, but those Gentiles who are appointed, or those Jews who are appointed to speak to Gentiles, or even Gentiles, deny it. That's what they're saying there, right?
Yeah, something like that. It's an old piece of wisdom that if you really want to know what's going on, you have to subscribe to Jewish newspapers.
Well, right, because then they tell the truth.
Because they don't convey to the general public the same things that they convey to each other.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, in any investigation of the Jewish question, the student is struck over and over again by the fact that what the Jews most complain of, they themselves began. They complain of what they call anti-Semitism. But it must be apparent to the dullest mind that there could never have been such a thing as anti-Semitism were there not first such a thing as Semitism. And then take the complaint about the Jews having to live in ghettos. The ghetto is a Jewish invention. In the beginning of the invasion of European and American cities, the Jews always lived by themselves because they wanted to, because they believed the presence of Gentiles contaminated them. Jewish writers writing for Jews freely admit this. But in writing for Gentiles, they refer to the ghetto as a surviving illustration of Gentile cruelty. The idea of contamination originated with the Jews. It spread by suggestion to the Gentiles. And so, with this fact of the separate nation, it was the Jews who first recognized it, first insisted upon it, and have always sought to realize that separateness both in thought and action. Nay more, the true and normal type of Jew today believes that the influence of Americanism or of any civilized Gentile state is harmful to Judaism.
Hmm.
That is a serious statement, and no amount of Gentile assertion will be sufficient to confirm it. Indeed, it is such a statement as the Gentile mind could not have evolved, because the trend of Gentile feeling is all in the opposite direction, namely, that Americanization is a good thing for the Jew. It is from authoritative Jewish sources that we learn this fact, that what we call civilizing influences are looked upon as being at enmity with Judaism.
Well, you know, this just strikes me, since I already mentioned National Socialism, that this is what the National Socialists were trying to do, in a sense, with the Jews, even in the camps, even as they were putting them in camps and want, you know, forcing them to take showers and be clean and, you know, and do all these things that were for hygienic things. And they looked upon it as, of course, they made it out to be that much more for propaganda reasons. But I think they did still look upon it as cruelty to themselves, causing them to submit to civilizing practices.
Yeah, well, I have a feeling that civilizing here doesn't really mean, no longer shoving a bone through their nose or whatever. I don't think it means civilizing in that sense. It probably means civilizing in the sense of becoming a part of the general society, assimilating, becoming, an American.
Yeah, there's that too. There's that too. But I still think, from what the rest of this says, is that, that they resent, they want to keep their Jewish practices, no matter how barbaric they might be. Yeah. But we'll see.
I don't think that's what it means, really.
Okay.
It is not the Gentile who says that Jewish ideals, as ideals, are incompatible with life in our country. It is the Jew who says so. It is he who inveighs against Americanism, not the American who inveighs against Judaism. As this article is one with the last, the same method of impassive presentation of the testimony will be followed. Readers of this study of the Jewish question should know that neither rhetoric nor emotion will contribute a single element to the solution of the question. We prefer to leave rhetoric and emotion to the anti-Semites who call names, and to the pro-Semites who are apparently reduced to the same necessitous level.
Okay, so, they're just saying that there's anti-Semitism, but then there's pro-Semitism or philo-Semitism, which is just as bad. I mean, it's just the opposite extreme. Neither one of them should be tolerated, according to them.
Now, the first thing to know is this, that though Americanism is yet unfinished, Judaism has been complete for centuries. And while no American would think of pointing to any part of the country or to any group as representing the true and final type of Americanism, the Jews quite unhesitatingly point to parts of the world and to certain groups as representing the true type of Judaism. Where is the type to be found which Jewish writers recognize as the true one. The Jew of the ghetto is held up in Jewish treatises as the norm of Judaism. The visitor in New York has perhaps seen on Central Park West the massive synagogue of the Spanish and Portuguese Jews. Its famous rabbi was the Reverend Dr. D. de Sola Poole. He is the author of the following words. In the ghetto, the observance of Judaism was natural and almost inevitable. The regimen of Jewish life was the atmosphere that was breathed. Not only did public opinion make it possible for men to go bearded, to keep the head covered at all times, to carry the palm branch in the public street, or to walk the street in stockinged feet on fast days, but public opinion made it almost impossible for a Jew to profane the Sabbath or the Passover regulations, or to openly transgress any of the main observances. And as we shall see later, the learned rabbi considers these conditions more preservative of Judaism than are American conditions.
Yeah, well, that's not barbaric or anything, but there's some example of they wanted to go bearded, they want to keep their head covered all the time, carry palm branches in public, wear their stocking feet down the street on their special days and so on. And all these things, you know, they are saying, this makes them more a Jew, a better Jew, and these are good things that they should preserve. And this keeps them from becoming Americanized and fitting in, you know.
Yeah, well, he also regrets the loss of the peer pressure of other Jews to make them keep their regulations.
Well, yeah, that comes up.
I think that's a major factor in Jewish life. The Reverend Dr. M.H. Siegel expresses the view that Jewry in the more modern portions of Europe and America was really kept alive by the infusions of immigrants from Poland and Lithuania.
Yeah.
Asserting in agreement with other Jewish leaders that the Jewish center of the world has been, until now, in Russia and Poland, Dr. Siegel says, "The war has destroyed the last traces of the declining Jewish society, which had dragged out its feeble existence in the semi-medieval ghettos of Poland and Lithuania. With all their growing feebleness, these communities were yet the last refuge of Judaism in the dispersion. In them, there had still survived something of the old Jewish life, something of the old Jewish institutions, practices, and traditions. These communities also supplied such vitality as they could afford to the attenuated and atrophied Judaism in the communities of the more modern states of Europe and America. The idea is not at all uncommon that large infusions of real Jews from the old world ghettos are desirable and necessary in order to keep Judaism alive in countries like the United States." Israel Friedlander, whose name just at present is held in peculiar honor by the Jews, and justly so, was a man of most enlightened intellect, and he too recognized the service of the ghetto stream to Judaism. In his lecture, The Problem of Judaism in America, he speaks about the de-Judaizing tendency of absolute freedom, such as the Jew has always enjoyed in the United States. This tendency, he says, is corrected in two ways: by anti-Semitic influences and by the large stream of Jewish emigration, on the other hand, which, proceeding from the lands of oppression to the lands of freedom, carries with it, on or under the surface, the preserving and reviving influences of the ghetto. The same authority, in an article entitled "The Americanization of the Jewish Immigrant," frankly prefers the Jew fresh from the ghetto to the Jew who has been influenced by American life. He says that he prefers the caftan-clad, old-fashioned Jew with his unattractive appearance and ungainly manners, whose whole life is dominated by the ideals and mandates of an ancient religion and civilization, to that modernized, amphibious creature, the gaudily attired, slang-using, gum-chewing, movie-visiting, dollar-hunting, vulgar and uncluttered, uncultured, quasi-Americanized gentleman.
Well, now I wonder if this Friedlander really believes that, or if this is some kind of stuff he puts forward. Because I didn't look up too much about this Israel Friedlander. I've heard of other Friedlanders. It's actually pronounced Friedlander, isn't it? Friedlander.
Friedlander.
Lender. I don't know if that's the same one though. He might. You know, it might sound good to say that, but do they really want all the Jews to be that way? They really want all, they've got all these rich and wealthy business type Jews, that I suppose, they probably they wouldn't like the gum chewing movie visiting. You know, they want the Gentiles to go to the movies, not the Jews. You know, they want to create all this kind of culture for the Gentiles, but not the Jews, so that the Jews remain this kind of separate, they haven't fallen so far, you know, they keep their religious instincts and so on. But the caftan-clad old-fashioned Jew, I don't know. I don't know that he would really want to keep that.
You know, in that movie Defamation, there's an interesting contrast between the Jews. You see, this Jew from Israel, I don't remember his name, he goes and visits the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, Abe Foxman, those people who are, you know, more or less Americanized Jews,
mm-hmm.
at least outwardly, and then he goes later and talks to some rabbi, I guess he is, in the Ukraine, who's, you know, it says that, you know, these people over in the United States, ADL, they're focused on anti-Semitism as a substitute for practicing Judaism. That's what he says, right?
Yeah, well, that makes sense. He's probably sincere in saying that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so the caftan-clad old-fashioned Jew, of whom Mr. Friedlander writes, is the Polish Jew, 250,000 of whom are coming to the United States as a preserving and reviving influence upon Judaism in the United States. Not to use more space, however, on the identity of the normal type of Jew, as precisely stated by those who have expressed themselves on this subject, it is possible to preserve the idea and add its logical complement by quoting some testimony on the Jewish view of Americanization. What now follows is of special interest because it is so generally stated and received throughout Jewish circles that the center of Jewry has shifted to America. It is so generally stated and received throughout Jewish circles that the center of Jewry has shifted to America. That is the form in which Jewish spokesmen make the statement. They say America, not the United States.
You know, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, America used to be used a lot by everybody back in those days and before, whereas now it's very much the United States. Well, I could be wrong about that. That's just some impression I have.
Well, there's that Neil Diamond song, you know, "They're Coming to America," glorifying immigration, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Huh. Neil Diamond.
A little story, a true one, may be worthwhile here. It may throw a sidelight on the use of the word American as used in testimony, in the testimony. A certain editor of an American newspaper gave a trifling bit of publicity to this series of articles. Jewish advertising was withdrawn from his columns by the chairman of the Anti-Defamation Committee of the local lodge of B'nai B'rith.
When they say to this series of articles, they mean these Dearborn Independent articles. They say it gave a trifling bit of publicity, and immediately, you know, they removed the Jewish advertising from that editor's newspaper. Boy, I think they were worse then than they are now.
Which chairman was also an advertising agent who handled all the Jewish advertising in that city? How convenient.
Yes.
The editor, not being a wise man, yielded to the bulldozing methods used upon him. And in a half-hearted bit of editorial praise for the Jews, used the word Americanism. The advertising agent toyed with the word in the manner of one who, having a weak Gentile in his power, would make the best of it. Why did you say Americanism? Why did you not say civilization? He asked. The editor to this day thinks it was a bit of captiousness. Nitpicking, in other words.
Oh.
It was not. There is meaning in it. To Americanize means, in our ordinary speech, to bring into sympathy with the traditions and institutions of the United States. But the Jews do not mean only the United States when they say America. They mean also South and Central America, where so many revolutions have occurred. There are large numbers of Jews in Argentina, and many are found in other countries. The next place to be extensively colonized will be Mexico. If the people
Well, I don't know if that happened, do you? I mean, I don't think that was extensively colonized. Actually, it was the United States that's been more extensively colonized all the time, rather than these other countries. But
I think there are a lot of Jews in Mexico.
Well, there are, but I don't know if you'd call it extensively. When did they all show up? I mean, I don't know. I don't either.
I don't know. They even have some Jewish celebrities in Mexico, although they usually don't advertise that they're Jewish.
Right.
If the people of the United States see a Jewish ambassador sent to represent them in Mexico, they must know that the invasion of that country is about to begin. If the ambassador is not himself a Jew, it will be well to scrutinize his connections. There may be reasons which will make it necessary to employ a Gentile front for a time. Well, that's going to strike some people as a little bit paranoid. Now, it would probably give a wrong twist to the fact to say that the Jewish leaders are anti-American, but it is true that they are against the Americanization of the Jewish immigrant stream. That is, the trend of Americanism is so different from the trend of Judaism that the two are in conflict. This does not indicate treason toward American nationalism, perhaps, so much as it indicates loyalty toward Jewish nationalism. But the reader must himself be the judge as to how far the difference goes. The testimony which will now be given divided itself into two parts. First, that relating to the American state in particular. Second, that relating to any Gentile state. After he had spoken in praise of the old type of Jew, as seen in the foreign ghettos, Dr. D. DeSola Poole added, "To a large extent, the adult Jewish population of the United States has been reared in Jewish communities of this type of Jewish inevitableness. To a large extent, the young generation is being reared in an atmosphere in which this type of Jewishness is unknown, or at least strange and impossible. Jewish religious observance in the United States is becoming increasingly difficult and increasingly rare." Describing the antagonism between the American and the Jewish tendencies, he continues with this reference to the effect of Americanism on Jewish modes of worship. "On the platform officiate a cantor and a preacher, who turn their backs to the ark and address themselves to their congregation. The talis and similar externals are un-American and have consequently been sacrificed. The American worships with bare head. Therefore, the American of Jewish persuasion must also doff his headgear when at worship."
Oh my gosh, he has to take off that great big black hat, huh?
Yeah, I guess. "Hebrew, an Oriental language, is not an American tongue. The American prays in English, which all understand. And accordingly, the American of Jewish faith has anglicized his ritual. Such a ritual is not susceptible of being chanted with traditional Jewish chazanot, and the music of the temple has therefore been brought up to date by the introduction of an organ, sacred music borrowed from non-Jewish neighbors, and mixed choirs, in which non-Jewish singers are almost the rule."
Non-Jewish singers in a Jewish synagogue? I find that hard to believe.
They might have some Negro singers.
Okay.
"The Jewish Sabbath is out of keeping with the environment, and the only way in which it seemed to be possible to save it was by celebrating it with a Friday evening temple service after supper and resting, and sometimes also attending temple on Sunday. It is not difficult to detect underneath these words the tone of criticism for such Americanization." No, it's not even underneath, I would say.
Right.
"It is a criticism which is fully justified by conditions. And it must be remembered that it was not uttered by a kaftan-clad, old-fashioned Jew, but by a learned rabbi with a magnificent temple on Central Park West, a man whom our government has seen fit to honor. But that is not all that Dr. DeSola Poole objects to, nor does he mince words in making his objection known. If so far reform has avoided the logical end of the process and has stopped short of identifying itself with Christianity, it has Americanized Judaism by dropping the elements that are characteristically Jewish and un-American, and has thereby created an almost non-sectarian Judaism housed in an almost non-sectarian temple." It will be noticed that the learned doctor uses the word American as one accustomed to quite another atmosphere. A further illustration is found in this: "Neglect of the un-American dietary laws is usually the first step that the Americanizing Jew takes in asserting his Americanism." The un-American dietary laws are, of course, the Jewish dietary laws. But if any Gentile writer had so referred to them, he would have been abused as a hostile witness. You know what? Most of the Jews that I've encountered love pork and bacon.
Well, so there's he's saying that he would have been abused. Well, why does he say that any Gentile writer referring to the dietary laws would have been abused as a hostile witness?
It's the word un-American.
Okay. Okay, there you go. Yeah. So to call anything Jewish un-American would be seen as anti-Semitic. Yeah.
Yeah. It is very curious indeed to read the long list of complaints against modern conditions in their power to bring about the decay of Judaism. The ghetto, which makes for separateness, is frequently heralded as the true safeguard of Judaism. Intercourse with the world is dangerous. Americanizing influences are distrusted. No doubt many, and many a Gentile parent in New York, Boston, Louisville, Dallas, and other American cities, has witnessed the spectacle of Jewish teachers and welfare workers instructing Gentile children in the principles of Americanism. But did anyone ever see a Gentile teacher instructing Jewish children in Americanism?
You know, that's really good, because it brings to mind there's so many examples in more modern times here where these Jews are constantly telling us what America stands for and what our principles are and so on. Of course, they started that in the 60s, right, with the civil rights movement, and it's been going on in those kinds of, you know, liberalizing areas and civil rights things ever since. And they're still doing it. But if you should, if a Gentile should talk to Jewish children and tell them about things, oh my God, you know, what right have you got to talk to our children? The hypocrisy
double standard.
Of it all, double standard, yeah, is so extreme with these people.
Recently, when the American Legion asked permission of the government to establish Americanization classes at Ellis Island, where tens of thousands of Polish Jews gain entry into the United States, the reply was a refusal. And the reason was that all the space for charitable institutions was already taken. What charitable institutions? How many of them were Jewish?
Yeah, well, I mean, most of them were Jewish. They had all these Jewish things going on at Ellis Island, so when they wanted to put in something that was more to help Americanize the people, there was no room for it. They had all this stuff set up to Judaize, keep them Judaized, tell them to go live in the ghetto and so on, I guess.
The beginning of this decay, says Israel Friedlander, referring to the effect of modern life on Judaism, is obviously coincident with the beginning of Jewish emancipation. That is to say, with the moment when the Jews left the ghetto to join the life and culture of the nations around them.
Oh, so when the Jews left the ghetto to join the life and culture of the nations around them, then they began to decay. Well, I'm all for this Friedlander. The Jews should go back in their ghettos, and they should go back among themselves and stay pure. I'm all for that.
Well, what it means is that the Jews, they have a love-hate relationship with this kind of openness. On the one hand, they want the openness so that they can go out and make money. On the other hand, it has this threat of assimilation inherent in it.
Well, exactly. And this Friedlander seems to be just one who is for the traditional Orthodox Jewishness. I would have to look him up if he was one himself.
Mr. Friedlander even went so far as to say that pogroms against the Jews were fortunate in that they drove the Jews back to their Judaism. Fortunately, however, Russian Jewry was halted on its downward rush toward national self-annihilation. The process of assimilation was cut short by the pogroms, and ever since then the Jews of Russia have stood firmly their ground. That may be the reason why some Jewish spokesmen of the Jews in America are trying to make this series of articles appear as a pogrom. There is plenty of evidence to indicate that Jewish leaders have regarded pogroms, in modern times at least, as very useful in preserving the solidarity of Jewry. However, those who are responsible for the present series of articles, much as they hope to benefit the general situation of the humbler Jews by showing the use which the leading Jews are making of them, must decline to be counted among those who justify pogroms on any ground whatsoever. And I think he's really onto something there about the pogroms being useful, but it's not so much the pogrom as the rumor of the pogrom that's useful to them. What's the Holocaust, right? The Holocaust, very useful for Jews in maintaining Jewish unity.
Yeah, and also any kind of anti-Semitism, anything they can point to as an anti-Semitic act. Just recently, this, what country was it in? Where that group of Jews was supposedly kind of beat up by a group of youths, probably Muslim youths. I forget where it was. And it's somewhere in Europe. And now they're able to make all kinds of noise, how they need to spend lots of money for security for themselves because they're, you know, all this anti-Semitic attacks that happened to them. You know, they make a big deal that these people did experience some bloodiness, some cuts and so on, from this attack by these kids. And then, of course, they make these governments, give them money to fund their security measures that they have to take. And they have all kinds of security. And, they don't want to pay for it themselves. They make the whatever government it is where they live, pay for it. The French do it and, the Germans do it and I don't know how much they get from other places, but that's their whole game.
Yeah. Another ramification of that I noticed some years ago is that Jews, organized Jewry, is much more bothered by calm and rational and unthreatening criticism than they are by somebody who seems to be really angry at Jews. They feel much more threatened by the calm, you know, like Ernst Zündel. Ernst Zündel was always like the harmless fuzzball of Holocaust revisionism, and that drove the Jews bonkers. Mm-hmm. Drove the Jews bonkers. They, you know, that's why they tried to kill him a few times.
Well, yeah, and they always try to portray that all these people are fanatical or angry and violent and so on. You know, in the media, they portray anti-Semites or critics of Judaism and so on that way. They never want to point to anybody who's giving a real... Well, but although they go after Kevin MacDonald quite a bit.
Yeah, we see Kevin MacDonald. He's very mild-mannered.
Yeah, because all right.
And so he's got credentials too.
Yeah, they don't like they don't like him. So a lot of these more mild people, they really are more they go after them more than the others. Well, then if you don't want to be bothered with Jewish censorship, then just get angry and call them name. You know, do it more extreme, and they'll leave you alone.
Yeah, that's right. If you breathe fire and you use a lot of nasty words, They won't be bothered very much. They'll feel that their assumptions have been confirmed, and that'll make them.
Yeah,
feel
and better. I guess you're working on their side because that's what they want. They want to have that in society so they can point to it. But that doesn't mean it shouldn't be done just because they think they can use it themselves.
Well, yes, there's another aspect to that, which is we need our own people to stop being afraid, and you don't want to appear to be mincing words.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's possible to to go overboard so that you're actually helping the Jews, I think.
Well, they want that. That's for sure. That's the point they're making here, that they want these pogroms. And they set it up themselves. They create pogroms. They create, they did in the past, they create anti-Semitic acts. They do them themselves. And how many times are these Jews found out, young ones, you know, sometimes, well, sometimes these older ones, and rabbis are found out for painting these swastikas or doing things like that.
That's right.
And it's then, why would anybody bother to do that? I would never bother to do such a thing as that.
That's right. Most of the time when there's a swastika painted on something, it's Jews that did it to themselves.
Right.
Most of the time.
And then reporting it. Oh, look, I'm so scared.
Yeah. Justice Brandeis of the United States Supreme Court is also an exponent of the idea that, released from ghetto influences, the Jew becomes less of a Jew. He says, we must protect America and ourselves from demoralization, which has to some extent already set in among American Jews. The cause of this demoralization is clear. It results in large part from the fact that in our land of liberty, all the restraints by which the Jews were protected in their ghettos were removed, and a new generation left without necessary moral and spiritual support. Justice Brandeis is a Zionist on these very grounds. He wants the land of Palestine because there the Jews, as he says, may live together and lead a Jewish life. Not the United States, but Palestine, is Justice Brandeis' hope for the Jews. He says of Palestine that there is only... What does that say?
There only can.
There only can Jewish life be fully protected from the forces of disintegration.
Oh, there only.
There only can Jewish life be fully protected from the forces of disintegration. That was unusually worded. Mm-hmm. Arguing the same question, the Reverend Mr. S. Levy says, I shall probably be told that the reestablishment of Jews as a nation would mean the recreation of the ghetto. I am frankly prepared to admit the force of the criticism, but with an important qualification dependent on the interpretation of the word ghetto. Insofar as the national center will ensure the existence of this Jewish environment, Jewish atmosphere, and Jewish culture, there will be a recreation of the ghetto. And emphasis was in Mr. Levy's text.
Where was the emphasis?
There will be a recreation of the ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
The continuance of Judaism is dependent on the existence of an area with an aggregation of Jews living in a Jewish environment, breathing a Jewish atmosphere, and fostering a Jewish culture. And these factors must predominate over all other influences. It is therefore plain, by the way, when I've heard Jews criticize the state of Israel, that's exactly what some of them have said about it, that to them it just looks like a ghetto.
The more liberated Jews or the ones that they don't like here, they think it looks... Well, see, they don't want to be. They don't want their own place. They want to run around in Gentile and Aryan societies and have a great time.
Yeah, right.
Take advantage of everything.
Yeah, exploiting the shiksas, right.
Right.
It is therefore plain that, however startling and improbable the statement may seem, when made by a Gentile, the Jews themselves regard the influences of modern lands as inimical to Judaism. But there is still a further consideration, which is distinctly set forth in Jewish writings, namely, that the trend of the modern state is harmful to all that Judaism holds to be essential to its moral and spiritual welfare. The modern state is changing, and Jewish observers sense the fact more readily than do the rest of the people, because Jews see in the change both an opportunity and a menace. If the state continues to change according to the trend of the general mind of the world, Jewish ideas of supremacy will find less and less opportunity to be realized. That is the menace. If the change or the spirit of change can be seized and twisted to Jewish purposes, as was done in Russia, and a Jewish type of state erected on the ruins of the old, that is the opportunity. Readers of these articles know that stimulation of the spirit of change is one of the clearest planks in the world program.
Oh, there we go again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't really believe in that world program, but okay. Although it resembles a lot of things that happened. As Cyril M. Picciotto points out in his Conceptions of the State and the Jewish Question, there is a tendency to increase the control of the state over the individual. This, of course, has nowhere been done so thoroughly as in Russia under the Jewish Bolshevik regime. But it is not of this that Mr. Picciotto speaks. It is of the tendency observed in the Gentile states, and he asks, in the face of such a tendency in political development, which it is not rash to assume will be more pronounced in the future than in the past, how does the Jew stand? He adds, the time is not far distant when the development of the state will continue on organic and collectivist lines. The central authority will embrace an ever wider area and will make such a penetration into the recesses of individual freedom as would have been thought inconceivable 30 or 40 years ago. Compulsory military service, compulsory education, compulsory insurance are but milestones on the road which logically leads to the adoption of a state morality, a state creed, and of a common way of life. To say this is merely to indicate the probable trend, not to approve it. How, then, is the state of the future going to deal with a people in its midst which largely preserves its separateness of blood, which, in its fasts, its festivals, its days of rest, its dietary laws, its marriage ceremony, suggests a distinct historic entity? The question is a disturbing one to Jews, as is shown by Rabbi Siegel's words in The Future of Judaism. He even says that the medieval state, with all its tyranny and obscurantism, was more favorable to the Jews than the modern type of state. Its defective organization permitted both individuals and whole classes to live their life in their own way. Hence, the medieval state enabled the Jews to organize themselves on semi-national lines, and, as far as circumstances permitted, to create afresh in their dispersion the national institutions and practices of their ancient commonwealth. They did this, of course, by establishing the ghetto. But this has become an absolute impossibility in the modern state, continues the rabbi. The rise of democracy and the transference of the ultimate power of government from the oligarchy to the majority involved the practical suppression of weak minorities. The identification of the state with the culture and aspiration of a particular nationality leads inevitably to the crippling of and gradual extinction of those classes who do not share that particular culture and those aspirations. The state, moreover, what he's saying is that the modern nation state is inherently genocidal. Yeah,
that's right. Well.
The state, moreover, enforces a system of education which is purposely designed to fashion and to mold all the inhabitants. It also maintains a thoroughgoing organization which embraces all the departments of the public and private life of all its inhabitants, irrespective of class, race, or tradition. There is thus no room in the modern state for Jewish culture, for Jewish national life, or for a specifically Jewish society, with its own specific institutions, customs, and practices. Therefore, Judaism can live and work only with a specific...
This is, I think, just the regular book, isn't it? No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Therefore, Judaism can live and work only with a specifically Jewish society and within a Jewish national organization. The medieval ghetto, with all its narrowness, with all the unhealthy and abnormal conditions of its existence, yet contained such a semi-national society. Therefore, Judaism flourished in the medieval ghetto. The modern state, on the other hand, has broken up that specifically Jewish society. Now, there are the reactions of leading Jewish minds to conditions in America particularly, and to conditions in the modern Gentile state generally. The statement of the antagonism which exists between the two is clear and complete. The Gentiles do not notice that antagonism, but the Jews are always and everywhere keenly aware of it. This throws a light, a very strong light, on all the revolutionary programs to break up the present control of society by sowing dissensions between capital and labor, so-called, by cheapening the dignity of government through corrupt politics, by trivializing the mind of the people through theaters and movies and similar agencies, and by weakening the appeal of distinctively Christian religion.
Well, I think we're going to have to stop there. We didn't finish.
I should finish this. A breakdown of Gentile seriousness is the opportunity of the Jew. A colossal war is also his opportunity, as witness his seizure of the United States government during the recent war. Judaism says that Americanism and Gentile nationalism generally are harmful to it. Judaism has therefore the alternative of changing and controlling Gentile nationalism or controlling.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.